Hello, and welcome to And Then, Power and Resources, a Transformational Innovation Opportunity. I'm Mary Ellen Frank, a private wealth advisor on the Montclair Investment Partners team here at UBS Financial Services. We're located on Park Avenue in New York, New York, and I can be reached at maryellen.frank@ubs.com. Our guest today is Jay Dobson, UBS CIO equity strategist covering U.S. energies and utilities. We're looking forward to an enlightening conversation. We are delighted today to have with us our colleague Jay Dobson. Jay's the UBS Chief Investment Office equity strategist for U.S. energy and utilities. Jay's responsible for energy equities, including oil, gas, refineries, midstream companies, and renewable energy, and a wealth of knowledge. Jay's widely recognized as an expert in those areas with over 30 years of experience as a research analyst, investment banker, and financial executive. So you've seen it all, Jay, right?
Yeah, for better or for worse.
Exactly. And I think that's really a good place to start. UBS has dubbed power and resources as a transformational innovation opportunity. Is this still the case with the volatility we've seen, with tariffs, with all the headlines, the way the market's been moving? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Mary Ellen, it's a great place to start. I mean, certainly when you look at markets and tariffs and even, you know, broad media, it's a volatile time. But I think what convinces us that the underpinning of this power and resources trio has a much, much longer duration than that is really just looking at what's driving it. You know, it's really artificial intelligence, it's reshoring, it's a lot of the things that are driving demand. And we're not seeing any of that change, quite frankly. We're continuing to see data center developers and hyperscalers want to grow their business. We're seeing reshoring here. We're seeing real-time data on energy and electricity demand that convinces us that that continues to grow and accelerate. So no, I would say these will certainly add complications. You know, tariffs drive up prices, volatile markets drive up the cost of capital. So there's certainly things to think about, and one shouldn't ignore them or dismiss them. But, you know, the underlying sort of secular drivers of this trend, you know, probably have, I would say conservatively, 5 to 7 years of duration. And my gut tells me it's going to be longer than that.
Exactly. I think that's the idea that it's transformational. It's at the beginning, and we're going to delve into that. But perhaps to start a little bit back further, in conversation before, we've discussed how there is a natural demand for energy. And I think sometimes we misunderstand when we think of energy, we only think of oil, we think of electricity, we think of utilities. But the demand for energy worldwide is constant, even outside of the new technology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's fair to say that, you know, energy is the lifeblood of the global economy. And if you sort of step back and think about, you know, oil is a big piece of that energy today. It's probably going to shrink, at least as a percentage of total energy over time. But it being a big piece, there's a very, very high correlation function between global GDP growth and oil consumption. So it really is, energy is what makes our life go round. I mean, I often tell people, imagine not being able to charge your cell phone or not being able to drive your car. These are really, really basic elements that, quite frankly, we take for granted until we have challenges like the lights go out or a storm, Mother Nature has her way. But no, energy really is an important part of our life. And even before we saw, you know, the advent of AI, energy demand was growing. It was growing slowly in the developed world. It was growing more rapidly in the developing world. Wouldn't surprise you, there's still, you know, well over a billion people globally that don't have access to electricity. There's, you know, more like 3 billion people that don't use the amount of electricity that folks in the developed world do by even a fraction. So over time, you can see the developing world continue to grow. Obviously, as economies grow in the developed world, that drives more energy consumption. We did see a period over the last 20 or 25 years of efficiency gains. We'll continue to see that across the globe, but I would expect that's probably slowing slightly as we all have LED bulbs and things like this in our homes. So no, energy is a big factor, and it's been growing, and that growth is accelerating.
Yeah, I can recall when one of the storms that came through, despite knowing there was no electricity, I insisted on like flicking the light switch on, and the shock when it didn't happen. And the sources and the raw materials that create energy, can you talk a little bit about what those are? Because I was really surprised to see that coal still played somewhat of a significant role in the production of energy.
Yeah, no, coal plays still a very, very important role, particularly when you look in the developed world, China and India. You know, we wrote a report before the Power and Resources report. We continued to talk about energy transition, and we did a really interesting analysis, you know, of China, for example, where we see they import an immense amount of oil and natural gas. But what do they have right in their backyard? They have coal. And so in a world where, you know, geopolitics are playing a bigger role, you know, countries like China, like India are going to say, you know, hey, I can control my energy cost by using what's in my backyard. And that's why you've seen an acceleration of use in coal in China and in India. It's not, you know, people say like, oh, coal's bad, coal's good. I think when you really get down to, particularly in the developing world, energy is what is good. So we have to really balance this. I think for a while, over the last decade or so, people have gotten very focused on decarbonization. And mm-hmm. I think you really have to say, in both the developed and the developing world, to the point you just said about, you know, turning your light switch on and off, we can all say we want lower carbon power or lower carbon electricity, lower carbon energy, until we don't have that power. And then, mm-hmm. you know, by and large, we saw that in Europe when, you know, they were lost their access to natural gas from Russia when Russia invaded Ukraine. You know, they lit an enormous amount of coal and wood on fire. So you start to say, well, we take affordability and reliability for granted in periods when we're really focused on decarbonization. But I like to describe it as a three-legged stool where mm-hmm. really it's all three of those, whether implicitly or explicitly, they help the stool stand. So no, I think it's a really, really important point. And just to level set everybody, when we talk about energy, we're talking about natural gas, coal, oil, derivatives of all of the above. And then we turn to power, which some of those sources used to generate power, but then as well, nuclear, wind, solar, biofuels. We're talking about all sources of energy and how they get converted. And you know, one has to keep in mind, we could go on about this a long time, but there's, you know, energy losses in that conversion. We get really excited about natural gas because it's, you know, 60-ish percent thermally efficient, but we're still losing an enormous amount of heat even while we're in that process. So yeah, energy is super important.
Yeah, it's amazing because it's, you know, energy is raw materials, the generation, the transmission, which you just mentioned, and then the distribution also. And along the lines of decarbonization, there was perhaps a return to drill, baby, drill. But we're seeing actually companies that you think of traditionally carbon-based companies taking on a whole new role, which leads us into the conversation of what's happening with data centers, AI, and so forth. So one of the things I'm fascinated with is a good old Pennsylvania, what is happening with Susquehanna Energy in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and then Three Mile Island. So I think that's a really strong indication of the absolute need for power and electricity.
Yeah, no, those are two great examples. And they really set up, I think, an important point. I mean, you know, had we been talking, let's say 5 or 10 years ago, and you said to me, Jay, what's a large electricity customer in the United States? I would have said 40 or maybe 50 megawatt, you know, steel smelter or something like that. When you get to today, you know, a large electric customer is like 1,000 megawatts or something larger than that. So these are enormous loads, but it's important to recognize, even if we go back to that 10-year, 50-megawatt steel facility, that would have been located very, very close to a power plant. And so what you're seeing is data centers in the Susquehanna example and in the Three Mile Island example, they want to locate, you know, in very close proximity to those power plants. Why? A, they have a lot of load, but B, if you have a lot of load, the further you locate away from a power plant, the bigger the expense, because you have to build a really, really big transmission line to bring the power to you. So it's much, much better to be co-located, as we say, co-location. That's what we've taken to calling it, data centers right near power plants. Susquehanna was the first one, and believe it or not, that was more than a year ago when they announced that with Amazon. It's still sort of pending some final determination at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I think the U.S. government will ultimately be supportive with some guardrails around it. I'm sure we'll talk about, Three Mile Island was a plant that had been shuttered, and actually they're restarting it, you know, based on demand that Microsoft was willing to underwrite for 20 years. We probably have another one, maybe two other nuclear plants in the U.S. we could restart. But by and large, most of the demand is going to require new supply.
If you're familiar with those very rural areas in Pennsylvania, what that development will do, you know, for that area is incredible. It's a lot of farmland, a lot of country there. And yeah, and so Microsoft with 20 years of output from Three Mile Island and Amazon's data center. And so you mentioned, you know, there's maybe still an existing nuclear power plant in the U.S. that could provide this. What's the lead time like if someone says, okay, I have this data center, I have this need that comes from AI, what's the lead time like to create an energy source or a transmission source for them?
I'll talk about that one nuclear plant, but let's talk more broadly. If we said decided to, you know, put our money together and try and develop one of these, and we needed 1,000 megawatts, and we were just starting that today, yeah, we probably wouldn't be able to get power much before 2030 or 2031. You know, when we talk about actual supply additions, if we build a nuclear plant, and we just built one in Georgia, Southern Company did, that took about 10 years to build. If you talk about a gas-fired facility, that takes about 5 years to build. Solar and wind are a little faster. You have to put batteries next to them so that they are something less than coincident resources. So those can bring on maybe 12 or 18 months. But, you know, the lead time on new supply takes a lot of time. I mean, when you look at some of the gas turbine manufacturers, you know, they're sold out through 2028 right now. So again, if we were saying, hey, instead of the data center, we want to develop a gas-fired power plant, we'd probably be looking at a delivery slot in 2029 or 2030 if we put money down today.
Now, that's incredible. Plus, whatever the local neighborhood might have to say about all of this good stuff too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually been not in my backyard, or NIMBY, as we call it in the industry, but you do want to make sure you're friendly with your neighbors, because this is, to your point, as rural Pennsylvania is showing, this is a lot of disruption, brings a lot of both positives and negatives, and you need to make sure the community is prepared.
Right, right. Now, and some also thoughts, if you have them, on this idea of the small nuclear reactors. You said there's, you know, the place in Georgia, there's Three Mile Island, but how likely is it? I think there's, they mentioned like 20 or so right now that are thinking about these, I wouldn't say portable, but small nuclear reactors.
Yeah, we call them small modular reactors, or SMRs for short. Look, this is a new technology, but I'd like to really remind everybody it's a new, old technology. You know, the reality is the United States government has probably 90 or 100 of these SMRs floating around the world. They're nuclear power plants that that fuel or power, you know, aircraft carriers and nuclear subs. So it really is just commercializing this technology. Now, you know, it's not to say that there are lower standards for the military. I might argue there's higher standards for the military, but the reality is you have to set standards so these can be put out into more commercial uses. The biggest challenge for SMRs is, you know, they're not here today. You know, I was with the CEO of GE Vernova last month, and, you know, we were joking over lunch. He said, hey, if you wanted to buy an SMR today, I'm not sure I could take your order because I don't know when I'll have them in production. And more importantly, I don't know what they're going to cost you. So I think this is more like 2030 is when you'll see this really starting to roll. You're probably 2035 or a little later before these are really ramping up and people can get access to them. That is far away, but it's really not that far away. I mean, remember, a nuclear plant in the United States operates for 80 years, very, very safely. It's worth saying the nuclear industry, which I've been around for all of those 30 years, a very, very safe technology. It's a scary technology, I will admit, but it is a very, very safe technology. These plants operate for a long time. SMRs may not operate quite that long, but they'll be long operations. So if we have to wait 10 years to get some good power out of these facilities for two or three or four decades beyond, it's well worth the wait. But it's not here today, to your point. There's not too many issues in the United States that are bipartisan, but I think nuclear is one of those issues that is bipartisan. You know, Republicans and Democrats agree that, you know, this is something that should be pushed forward and developed. You know, we're still not there yet. We could spend a whole podcast or hour discussing this, but you know, the reality is, as we saw in Georgia recently, these plans take a long time to build. There's a lot of financial risk during construction. So we've got to get over some of those hurdles. But yes, I believe it's bipartisan. And I do think that you will eventually see it, even if it's just waiting for SMRs. But I'm sort of hopefully a pretty big fan of nuclear. I'm sort of hopeful that we're going to see it develop. Yes, demand has the potential to grow much faster than supply, but it's not the point that demand ever outstrips supply. You know, a lot of people are saying, well, what if, you know, the lights go out or things like this? Most utilities in the United States operate with a civil obligation to serve. So they have literally a legal obligation to serve power. So what you're not going to see is them connect data centers that would put that reliability at risk. I do think overall, this demand is inflationary to the system, and it's something that it's got to be managed. Now, I do think these, you know, large data centers are very comfortable. You know, electric power for them is a reasonably small part of the overall cost equation. So many of them are willing to say, yes, we'll underwrite. For example, Microsoft did with Three Mile Island restart. They said, hey, we'll underwrite the entire cost of the restart within reason. There's a contractual arrangement there that shares that restart risk. But once it is, they're paying sort of full bore for the restart. So I don't think that it is something that really drives retail electricity prices up tremendously. But I would also want everyone to get comfortable with the idea that, yeah, as demand rises, and it's all of us driving some of that demand, yeah, I do think electricity prices across the country will be rising, you know, pretty close to the rate of inflation. They've been rising well below that for the 10 years prior to the last two. And yeah, they're probably rising. And again, that inflation is not an inflated inflation rate. It's more like a normalized sort of, I don't know, 3-ish%, what the Federal Reserve talks about, 3% inflation rate. So you will see some higher power prices, but it's probably not out of control.
I think you had mentioned that AI poured gasoline on the electric demand.
What you're seeing a lot of data centers consider is maybe they just go off grid and they totally island themselves. So you essentially build a data center and then you build a power supply and a redundant power supply. Remember, you want very reliable power right next to that data center and you're islanded or shut off from the grid. That's one consideration. You have other considerations where maybe you bring, you know, wind and solar on in large amounts so that you're across many of the periods of the day offsetting a lot of your use. It's a really good question. There's a lot of folks, Duke University and others, are doing a lot of work on this. I could get into a lot of detail, but I think the one concept to think about that makes you feel more comfortable is when you look at the U.S. electric system, it's really underutilized. And that's not because it's poorly run. It's because demand fluctuates, you know, dramatically across seasons. But even when you just think about a day, you know, we're all asleep and then we wake up and we turn on the light and the coffee pot and then maybe the heat and then day heats up and it's air conditioning. And then we go home and we cook dinner. So you can see a pretty good cycle to that load. When you look at electric power plants in this country, they run about 40-42% of the time. And that's an average across all. Obviously, nuclear plants are meant to turn on and run flat out, but across all assets, they run about 40% of the time. So then you say, really, the amount of new supply we need is for those really peak times, the hottest day in the summer in July at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And that's when you're trying to. So I do think there's more supply here than maybe we all appreciate. But it definitely, I wouldn't argue at all that in the development process, not so much the commercialization, in the development process, you know, thinking about where you're going to get your power is critical. Saying just one other way, and I don't want to dwell on this, you know, if you talk to a data center developer maybe 10 years ago, they would have said, well, you know, latency is number one. And then once latency, sort of water access. I would say if you talk to a data center developer right now, they say my number one, two, and three priorities are power, power, and power. After we get through that, then we'll talk about, you know, latency and access to water and all these things, of course, which are critical to a data center.
Yep. Terrific. I think a sort of a mid-sized NVIDIA chip uses as much power as one U.S. household. And most of the power in data centers is used for cooling, right? So with the HVAC that goes into it. So absolutely critical.
The utility is an obligation to serve, but more importantly, they're regulated at the state level. So they invest money and then they file a rate case and they get a return on equity. And then they sort of set a tariff, like your electricity price, depending upon where you are in the country, you know, your tariff, your price of electricity is reasonably set. The independent power producers resulted largely as a matter of partial deregulation of the electric system, but they essentially sell power into the wholesale market. So they are supplying that power to the wholesale market. And what you're seeing in the Susquehanna nuclear plant and others is where they're saying, hey, I'm not going to sell it to the wholesale market anymore. I'm going to sell it retail. And of course, why do the IPPs want to do that? Because they obviously get your retail prices higher than the wholesale price. So they get a big margin increase. And they obviously also lock up for 10 or 15 or 20 years. So that's a real opportunity for them. Yeah. They are also people who can, you know, are willing to commit capital and to grow faster than the utilities are. So, no, I think the independent power producers are really well positioned in this environment. I think the only risk to them, and it's the question that Mary Ellen started this discussion with, is, well, you know, is AI slowing down or is there some element that makes the demand growth much slower? And I don't see any hints of that at all. I think the key really is what is, you know, federal policy going to be? The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, as I mentioned earlier, is dealing with this issue right now. They're likely to make an issue, or sorry, a ruling by middle of this year on exactly what the rules are for that co-location of data centers next to power plants so that you can make sure that everybody's needs are balanced. But yeah, the independent power producers are really well positioned in this environment.
I think that that's interesting and a sort of new information to think about, that we're not constrained in terms of supply right now, and maybe it's more situational. Could you talk a little bit about the grid itself? Because I think there's some opportunities in thinking about the continued improvement. If it's overhead wires, they have a natural kind of lifespan in terms of and how power is delivered. And then would it be possible if some of these sort of ring-fenced power plants for data centers would be called upon?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the whole grid side of things is very, very interesting, mostly because when you go back all the way 100 years or so, you basically had these little grid systems developing around the country, you know, one in Chicago, one in New York, one in New Jersey. And then what happened was people realized, well, if we interconnect these systems, then we're sharing resources. And so essentially, the development of the transmission, U.S. electric transmission system as we know it today, was really just connecting these systems. And then it was, as we got more energy intensive, electricity intensive, it was bringing power from large power plants to the load centers. You know, today, if we think about wind and solar, those come from different locations than, say, a coal or a nuclear plant did. So you do need to rethink and perhaps, you know, increase investment dramatically in transmission and distribution. But it's not at all where some people always tell me, well, it's because the industry was poorly managed or didn't invest. Remember, most of the industry up until about 30 years ago was fully regulated. So they could and obviously had an incentive to invest as much as possible, but each of those investments resulted in higher prices to customers. So I would say those still exist today. There's a lot of opportunity to invest in the grid because we're going to see more power demand, means more infrastructure, means making sure reliability, because all those transmission lines increase reliability. We're sharing more resources. So yes, I would argue there's a lot of opportunities in the power and resources theme around investment in transmission and wires and transformers and all of these things that allow for the supply of electricity to end-use customers.
The things we never think about, like the gas turbines, right? That will be in scarce demand. And as you mentioned, you don't see really a slowdown in demand from AI. There was a whole, you know, kerfluffle when DeepSeek came out and it seemed like they could do it more efficiently. But the amount of heat that's generated by these chips and then the demand for AI. So perhaps one risk is if AI turns out to not have such a demand. Any thoughts about that and what it would mean for, you know, this particular?
I still think the question is how fast is that demand going to grow? And I would tell you, we talk to a lot of consultants, anybody who stands in front of you and says they know exactly where electricity demand is going to be in 20 or 20 or 35 is lying to you. But the reality is, you know, we are seeing enormous growth in, say, NVIDIA's chips and those sales. And as you pointed out, those chip, a single chip alone, if we run it at full power, which again, you have to make some assumptions about how much it's running. Yeah, each one of those chips uses about the power of a US household, and we're putting hundreds of those into a single data center. So we can have a pretty good line of sight on how this is developing. And to your point, whether you're talking, you know, hyperscalers, Microsoft or others, now I think a lot of this is where they're deciding to locate data centers, not actually their total capital spending, which has not changed. I would also point out that I think a lot of these companies are dealing with many of the same things you mentioned in your opening question, Mary Ellen, which is, hey, these are really uncertain times, and these hyperscalers are spending tremendous amount of money to develop this, you know, AI theme. I think they're very committed to it, but, you know, they, just like any one of us on this call, you know, are loath to make, you know, a rash decision that they regret just in order to get speed to market. That's not to say speed to market's not important, because these guys want to move fast. But I think that is as much the issue, rather than Microsoft or anybody else thinking, well, I'm not really sure about this sort of AI theme. I think that is, yeah, you know, out the door. The question really is, how fast does demand grow? And I would still, sitting here in, you know, whatever, April of 2025, I would still say the risk is to the upside, not to the downside. That's not to say it's non-existent. We could have economic contractions and other things that challenge that growth. But I would say AI and reshoring specifically, yeah, the risk is to the upside, not the downside, as I see it right now in demand.
Yeah, that's very interesting, mentioning reshoring and what that may mean to bring it back also, right? And cities like Hazleton and Scranton, Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah.
This has been very enlightening, right? Pun intended. I really thank you for your time, and let's keep the conversation going. So thank you very much.
Please. Thank you, Mary Ellen. If anybody has follow-up questions, don't have them hesitate to reach out to you. You can always find me.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.